Joshua Porter is the director of web development at User Interface Engineering, and he's a member of their research team in the UIE. You guys go by that. focus on such topics as on-site search systems and cross-browser compatibility issues. In his spare time, he also drives the development of the company's website. And I found out this morning that he and a bunch of his friends have a blog about sports. So he's an avid blogger. Josh also writes about web design and technology, and most notably what you're here to listen to today, Web 2.0, on his blog called Bacardo. And the URLs are on your agenda and bios, so you can check those out later. So without further ado, I give you Josh Porter.
Thank you, Beatrice. Can you hear me if I stand right here, this far away from the microphone? Okay. Yes, as Beatrice mentioned, I am the director of web development at User Interface Engineering. In addition to some of the very specific topics that Beatrice mentioned, like cross-browser compatibility, which is actually a necessity for creating websites that I create, we actually take a much broader outlook at design and websites and software. We at User Interface Engineering, we consider ourselves a behavioral research company. And what I mean by that is we actually watch and learn how people use the web. We try not to make any assumptions ahead of time, and we've done, to give an example, last summer we did a huge e-commerce study where we tested 72 people on 12 of the largest e-commerce sites in the world, including Amazon, Best Buy, Circuit City, and several sites like that. And the research that we do is to watch how people use those websites, how they integrate those websites into their lives, how they purchase things like digital cameras, computers, which is very interesting. It's so interesting, in fact, that we pay people upwards, in that study, upwards of $1,500 just for a three-hour session. So if you're interested in doing that at any point, if you find that sort of thing interesting, you can go to UIE.com and sign up to be a part of our studies. I had no idea that O'Reilly books would be out there this morning. And I was just looking through my bag, and I found this book, Tim O'Reilly in a Nutshell. And this is a fabulous book. I was just looking at it. I actually was at the Web 2.0 conference in October, and I met Tim O'Reilly. I spoke to him very briefly. But I listened to him. He was kind of an MC for the conference, and he spoke a lot about Web 2.0, of course. As some of you may have read a pioneering article by him called "What Is Web 2.0?" that was published on the O'Reilly Network approximately 2 months ago. And the term Web 2.0 actually came out of the O'Reilly company, the O'Reilly Media, and Basically, without getting too deep into the specifics of where it came from, the folks at O'Reilly were looking at all the trends they were seeing around the web and saying, okay, what things can we point at and say, okay, this is a real indicator of change. This really teaches us something about how we build websites and systems to support people's needs. And at some point, Dale Doherty, who's a longtime O'Reilly employee, said, yeah, it kind of sounds like Web 2.0. And at that point, it kind of stuck. And so they eventually named the conference Web 2.0. Unfortunately, it's a very tough topic to pin down. And part of what I'm going to be doing today is to talk about it in terms of change and not necessarily defining it, because I'm not really sure it's that important that we have like a one-sentence definition as to what it is. What I do think is important is if we all can agree that there's something big going on here, okay? And you might not call it Web 2.0, you might call it Web 3.0. You might not call it Web 2.0, but you might just kind of look at this and say, okay, these blogs seem to be having this real big effect, or wikis seem to be having a real big effect. Something's changing, and we need to change our systems accordingly. We can support users better than we have in the past. And so that's really the point of Web 2.0 for me. And as Beatrice mentioned, I blog about this a lot, almost on a daily basis. And I've really, for many months now, I've gone away from actually trying to define the thing. There's been a ton of pushback on other blogs lately about what is Web 2.0, and I think that actually misses the point. I think the point is that we're going through this big change. It's happening this year, kind of started a few years ago, and we're still pushing through it. It's a big trend, and that's what I'm going to be talking about today. A quote that really kind of sums up what's going on here is this one. This was written by Kevin Kelly in the August edition of Wired magazine, in an article called "We Are the Web," and the quote is this: "The accretion of tiny marvels can numb us to the arrival of the stupendous." And I think it's such a great quote for what's happened in the last 10 to 15 years. If you think about how you lived your life 15 years ago and how you live your life today, they're completely different. If you've use the web at all. 10 years ago, if you had asked me, would you ever do banking online? Would you ever give someone your social security number or provide someone with your bank account? I would say absolutely not. If you asked someone 10 years ago, would you ever buy a car online? You would say probably not. That, you know, I'd always want to look at the car before I bought it. And there's a million of those examples. We are taking everything we do offline, and in many cases, we're representing the same. We're modeling it online, and that's an amazing thing. It's an amazing change. And in the last 10 years, we've seen as much change in how we go about our day-to-day business as we have in any other decade. In history, and really the reason, of course, is because of the web, because you can learn about anything at a moment's notice. If I needed to look up this quote, it would take me less than 10 seconds. If I had my browser in front of me open, I would type in the first four words in Google and press return, and that's it. And so those, you know, what sorts of changes does that portend? But I'm here to talk at a program that's called Hack, Build, or Buy. And so, one thing that I was thinking about when I was taking this quote into consideration, because I try to work this quote in everywhere that I possibly can, is that we can slightly alter the quote, and I altered it here to the accretion of tiny hacks can numb us to the arrival of the stupendous. And I don't say this lightly. I think this is just as true as if we use the word marvels. The web has always been about hacking. From day one, the web was about hacking. And what do I mean by hacking? Well, here are some examples of what I would call Web 1.0 hacks. And if any of you are web developers, these are very near and dear to your hearts, okay? Font tags are actually a hack. They're a display hack. They weren't included in the original HTML specification. But people realized, you know, I want to use the fonts that are on my computer. I don't want just Times New Roman. So the browser maker said, okay, we'll provide a font tag. Tables for layout. Has anyone ever used tables for layout? Nested tables are, I actually had a website once in which I had 7 nested tables, and that was the limit for, I think it was Netscape 3 at the time, and someone emailed me and said, yeah, I was looking at your site and it's a blank page, because I hadn't tested it on Netscape 3, and it turns out that 7 nested tables was the limit or thereabouts. spacer GIFs, which go along with tables for layout. And one of the more interesting Web 1.0 hacks is that browsers forgave rendering issues. They forgave incorrectly marked up documents. So for example, if you had a paragraph tag, a p tag, and you didn't close it, the browser would still render that pretty well, in fact. And this idea that you don't have to be perfect, that you're, that the information that you publish doesn't have to be perfect, is a really empowering thing. Okay, imagine if we all had to speak in correct sentences. You know, as we converse with people, we hack English or whatever language you're speaking to death. I say ain't, I say you know, I say I say a whole bunch of things that, you know, speakers are really worried about saying. But for the most part, I think I'm hopefully actually saying words that make sense. Okay, so I'm hacking English as I'm standing here. We have systems like browsers that forgive us all a whole bunch of inaccuracies in what we render. And really what that lets us do is focus on the message, which is really the important thing of the web. So the web has always been about hacking. And I think that that's one of the primary lessons that in the next 10 years will really affect the way that we build systems. So that brings me, I kind of have a little diagram here of Web 2.0. It brings me to the, excuse me. It brings me to the idea of lesson learned from the dot-bomb survivors, okay? So and what the companies that I'm referring to are the ones that were started back in the mid-90s, okay? That are still around, and they've become almost a cliche now. Amazon.com, Yahoo.com, Google.com, eBay.com. Okay, these things are such a part of our daily lives, we take them for granted. And we, you know, it's kind of like if you have anything in your attic, it's, oh, sell it on eBay. If you're looking for a book, well, did you read the reviews on Amazon? If you're searching for something, you just Google it, okay? It's becoming part of our language. So one thing that I think is really important is that we don't let the lessons those companies are teaching us every day pass on by. So when we talk about Amazon reviews being this really amazing feature, we could kind of just say, yeah, you know, and let it pass. But if we really focus on Amazon reviews as an artifact of human behavior, as something that was taken offline and put online, then we see it in kind of a different light, and we see that it's actually representing our offline lives online, and it grows a cultural significance because of that. So let's think about hacking from a different angle. Okay, what if we kind of took the idea of hacking and just kind of changed how we look at it a little bit and set it equal to designing on the fly? I mean, that's really what hacking is, isn't it? You know, it's solving a problem, okay, that which is what most of design is about. And it's just kind of doing it on the fly. You don't write up a whole specification sheet to do hacking, otherwise it would be design or something. But it surely wouldn't be hacking. So we were up here earlier, me and the AV guys, and we're kind of hacking a little bit with the technology to make sure that my presentation shows on screen. Well, we can call it hacking, or we can say, you know, we're designing what we hope to be the best experience for you people right now. And so the best experience for you people is probably to see my slides as opposed to not see them. And so we're actually designing an experience here. The best experience for me right now is to see my slides with a little clock underneath it so I can keep time. So that's actually what I'm seeing on my screen. So if we look at hacking as design on the fly, we start to notice that we get away from some of those things that we do sometimes when we have all the time in the world to design. And the things I'm talking about is we tend in hacking, we tend to focus on context and current user needs instead of standards and conventions. Okay, so we do whatever needs to be done to solve the problem. And if you think about computer hackers, that's exactly what they do. They simply break into a computer. Actually, that's serious hackers, which are also known as crackers. But they break into a computer using any means necessary. There is no, this is how you break into a computer, okay? They'll call on the phone to get a password from someone. They use any means necessary. And so they're actually focusing on the context of the situation as opposed to any specific way of doing things. One thing that hacking does is it brings in the ire of purists. So if you talk to a web standards advocate and you talk about Google.com, they'll say, ooh, you know, Google, they use tables. Amazon uses tables. You know, that's so the horror. You know, and then Amazon says, oh yeah, by the way, we had like more revenue than all the other companies combined or something. So when you're talking about solving a problem, standards are secondary. Hacking also lends itself to multiple iterations, trial and error, a repetitive process over and over. These are the things that these companies are doing that we can really learn from. If you go to, if you're a regular user of Amazon, you'll notice things change all the time. In fact, just in the past month or two, they've really changed the way their book pages are. They've gone from a three-column layout to basically kind of a one and a half column layout, where the picture of the book is much bigger than it used to be, and that was completely iterative. The way Amazon does a lot of their development is that they try something on a small subset of the users, and then they, if it's successful, if they see an uptake with those users, then they'll roll it out to the rest of the folks. And what I really want to stress here is that hacking is how innovation most often happens, especially on the web. It's so central to the web, in fact, that if browsers didn't have the view source capability, the web wouldn't be nearly what it is today. And as I mentioned, if you look at the big four, the four horsemen or whatever you want to call them, and you look at their websites, they're riddled with HTML hacks, okay? Actually, Yahoo is getting a little better on this, but Google, eBay, and Amazon are riddled with tables for layout, bold tags instead of strong tags, and all those things that web standards advocates would tell you are wrong. But they're succeeding as companies. They're providing more user value than all the other companies. So that's what we have to focus on. And so instead of focusing on, well, does your page validate and does it use tables for layout? Because it shouldn't. Should you be using divs and CSS and this other stuff? If we think about the people who are the most successful, they're not doing that. So that's a clear lesson. So when we look at those same sites, they have a bunch of HTML hacks, but they also have something that I would call social hacks. Okay, and these are a result of their design processes. Okay, on Google. We have, when you type in a query, and sometimes right at the top of the screen you have, did you mean? Basically, it's like, say you typed in D-O-G-G dog. It might say, did you mean D-O-G dog? On Amazon, they have customers who bought this also bought. Top 100 reviewers, those are both Amazon. Why are we making you sign in again? That's a favorite thing to do on Yahoo.com. They make you sign in like every 3 seconds, it seems like. And on eBay, you often see leave feedback for the seller. Okay, these are all social hacks. These are all things. These are all pieces of their design that interact with people socially, and These, in fact, were not part of the original design plan. These were things just like I was talking about with Amazon iterating their pages. These are things that they tried out. They seemed to work. A really interesting story about Google's Did You Mean is that they don't use a synonym dictionary for that feature. In a book a lot of you folks might be familiar with, Information Architecture for the World Wide Web, by Morville and Rosenfeld, they talk a lot about synonym dictionaries, about thesauri, things like that. And so one would assume that that might be how you create something like Google's Did You Mean feature, but that's actually not how they created it. They actually created it by looking, okay, observing actual behavior and seeing, you know what, sometimes people, when they type in D-O-G-G dog, right afterwards they type in D-O-G dog. We see a lot of people doing that on our site. So what they did was they said, okay, well, we're going to anticipate that. So for all the, you know, and we're talking billions of queries here, for all those queries that people typed in something, 5 seconds later, they actually brought that to the forefront. So when someone types in D-O-G-G dog, they preempt their next move by saying, did you mean D-O-G dog? So it has nothing to do with a synonym dictionary, although I suppose you could easily create one out of the data that they have. And that's why sometimes when you type in something, the did you mean doesn't actually make much sense, and the results on the second page aren't actually that useful. It's because they're not using a synonym dictionary, and they're not specifying ahead of time how all this stuff works. So the major lessons learned from the dot bomb survivors. The first one that I talked about is hacking is not just okay, it's actually good for innovation. And the Google Did You Mean example is I think an archetypal example of that. Is that if you look to see what people are doing, what people are having a trouble with, you can oftentimes, if you can pinpoint the exact problem, the solution just falls right out. So their solution makes all the sense in the world now, but it wasn't part of their original design. And a couple other ones I just want to mention. But I'm going to go on to some other stuff. The users are the most important asset of a company. Okay, when you look at a company's balance sheet or an organization's balance sheet, a library's balance sheet, anybody's balance sheet, users are not on that list. Assets are always talked of in terms of money. Okay, but if that's the case, if we assume for a second that assets are all about money, how on earth was Skype just sold for $2 to $3 or $4 billion to eBay? Skype was making very, very little money, okay, but their user population was gigantic. So they actually were sold on their user base. And a corollary to that is that attention in our economy is now almost as important, if not more important, than money. And what I mean by that is attention substitutes for money now. So everybody's giving their attention to Skype. eBay sees that and says, okay, we want that attention too. We're not getting money directly, but we're getting their attention. So now we have a much easier time of creating a new user base from the Skype user base. And so now, is everyone familiar with Skype? Sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. I should definitely explain that first. Skype is a internet telephony software. Basically, it's like a telephone on your computer. If I install the Skype application and someone else has installed the Skype application, I can basically talk. My microphone will pick it up. Skype will send it to the other person's computer, and it will come out their speakers, just like a telephone conversation. It's very fast. It's clearer than my cell phone, and in fact I've talked to a guy that I know from New Zealand on it, and the latency is as good as a cell phone. I mean, it's really an amazing application. There's something like 30 to 40 million people using it now, and it's free. So another issue that we're seeing a lot that we're learning from the dot bomb survivors is that scalability is as important as algorithm. If you go on the web today, you can find out how Google indexed search pages. Okay, you can not exactly, of course, but you can find out the original research that Sergey Brin and Larry Page did at Stanford. It's published. It's there. Anybody can find it out. What you can't find out is how they scale their website to include billions of queries a day. You cannot find that out. In fact, that's as closely guarded a secret as anything. Okay, I'm going to move on quick. So the first kind of quadrant that I wanted to talk about was the lessons learned from the dot bomb survivors. I think it's really important to learn from at least those four companies, if not some of the other companies. There are millions of niches out there now. Each niche has their leader. It's okay to look at their website and not necessarily copy features, but figure out what they've done, how that is helping their users live their online life, and then simply apply it to your own problems, which are undoubtedly different. So the next thing I want to talk about, I know there's definitely some interest in this, is new enabling technologies. I actually, I had an email sent to me from some questionnaires that you filled out about, let's see. Kind of like, what are you hoping to learn or gain from this program? And so I want to stress here that if you have questions about any of the technologies that I'm talking about, I'm going to mainly talk about RSS, but if you have any technologies about how they might relate to your specific library issue, please don't hesitate to yell them out. Okay, so first I want to talk about RSS and the subscription model. Everyone's familiar, all too familiar, with spam now, email spam. Okay, email is... to kind of step back a little and just look at the model of how email works, email is what we call a push technology, so that people can push information at you once they know how to do that. So once they know your email address, they can just send you as much junk as they want. Contrast that to RSS, okay? Is there anybody who uses RSS on a regular basis? Okay, could you just yell out a reason or two why you use it? Anybody? It's efficient.
It comes better than email.
It comes to you, exactly. It's a pull technology. And it's kind of based on this kind of a subscription idea. So that once you find an RSS feed out there on the web, you subscribe to it, and then whatever information is published there, you now pull it to you. Okay, it's based on permission. So any Seth Godin fanatics out there, he's all about permission marketing. RSS is the key permission marketing technology, because people have to agree. You need their permission to talk to them, and that permission comes in the form of them subscribing to your feed. I talked to a fellow by the name of Charlie Wood. At the Web 2.0 conference, he is doing enterprise RSS integration. And what I mean by that is he is going into companies and finding out where their communication breakdown is. And many times he can simply come up with an RSS solution that bridges those breakdowns. So if you're, like, let's say, for example, you're sending out an email every month of the newest books in your library. This is an ad hoc example, so if this doesn't make sense, just please let me know. But imagine you have new books come into your library every month. That's a perfect example of where RSS would be ideal to let people know about your content. Because then, if someone subscribes to, we call it the new books RSS feed, then people can, once they're subscribed, they'll only be notified when you have new books. Okay, so you're not wasting any time marketing to them, you know, and killing their attention otherwise. You're only telling them when you have new books, and that's all they've asked for. And they're only notified, they're not distracted until you have new books. So they open up their RSS reader that day and they say, oh, you know, great, they have this the new Tim O'Reilly in a Nutshell book, I'm gonna go pick that up, or whatever. Other benefits, because it's based on a permission model and it's a pull technology, there's no spam in RSS. Okay, I read something like 400 RSS feeds, or I shouldn't say that. I'm subscribed to 400, only, you know, 20% get updated each day. So one day I'm reading news from this blogger, the next day I'm reading news from another blogger, but I'm only notified if something is new. So it's an amazing gain in efficiency. Unfortunately, the gain in efficiency is offset by the number of feeds that you now subscribe to. So whereas before, I would go to 10 websites a day and check what was new. I'd go to CNN, I'd go to New York Times, I would go to my favorite blogs, and that was the extent, because my attention is finite. I only have so much of it. Say I only have half an hour attention a day to read up on the news. So I go to each of those 10 websites. Now with RSS, I'm pulling everything toward me. I open up my RSS reader, and there's 100 sites with new information. So I still take my half hour. Now I'm going to tell you about an application called housingmaps.com. Housingmaps.com is, this is the interface to it. There's the URL. It's a tool that allows people to find real estate. Okay, and I've brought up a map of Boston here, and you'll notice that on the left hand side is this really, you know, nice map. Most of you will be familiar with online mapping applications. If you look down here on the left, you'll see this Google here. So this application is built with Google Maps technology. If you look in the top right here, If you look in the top right here, you'll see Craigslist. This application is actually built half in Google Maps and half in Craigslist. All these real estate listings are coming from Craigslist. This map was built with Google Maps. This is an archetypal Web 2.0 website because it's gathering information from more than one information source and creating a new, more efficient, better, cooler, nicer, easier to use tool on top of that. You'll see in the top left that you can look for properties for sale, you can look for rooms for rent, you can look for sublets. There's several cities, and there's a ton more. There's dozens of cities now. You can choose different price ranges. There's also filters like, do they allow pets, things like that. So So the guy who made this, I actually met at the Web 2.0 conference as well. His name is Paul Rademacher. He was a lead animation engineer for DreamWorks Pictures. And after meeting him, I realized he's a pretty hardcore programmer. But he built this in his spare time. He built this application in his spare time. It wasn't part of his work. And in fact, at the time, both of these information sources weren't necessarily allowing people to do this. So he went to Google Maps, he figured out how it worked, and he went to Craigslist and he figured out how that worked, and then he pulled all that information in and created this application. And this type of thing is commonly called remixing. That's kind of the Web 2.0 way to describe it, is it's a remixed application because it's mixing two other applications. Okay, so now I want to look at just, this is just Google Maps. So a lot of you might be familiar with this if you just use your map application, typed in MIT Cambridge Mass, it brings up, it has these little balloons of various places, and then it has this big call out balloon that shows you finer detail. So this is the Google Maps application. And all this stuff is built in. So Google has taken this list of items. This is kind of, they get this list from like a Yellow Pages type of source, Super Pages, Yellow Pages types of things. So then they Google is actually combining this information for their application. And in fact, oh, I'm sorry, you can't see it there. But if you go back here and you look down here, it says map data copyright NavTech. So Google is actually taking data from another map provider and remixing it in their application. So anyway, the point is that there's remixing going on everywhere. There's Yellow Pages, NavTech, Google Maps, Craigslist. And this is the way, or this is a primary way that design will be done from this day forward, from Web 2.0 forward, is combining these information sources. So then we look at a close-up. Okay, this is a I think it was an apartment, or maybe a condo. I'm not sure. There it is, condo. So it was a condo for a lot of money in Boston. And when you click on this link, you're actually taken to Craigslist. So this is the page on Craigslist that you get. And you can find out all about it. So it's actually, it's not keeping you on housing maps. You can actually go to Craigslist. And this is, as you know, what... so many people are familiar with Craigslist, I kind of assume that everyone is now. Craigslist is kind of like a local classifieds for all the major cities in the world. In fact, my friend in New Zealand said they have one in Wellington now. So if you look here, this is a very simple interface. I mean, as almost as simple as you can get. And they have really styled very little. But when we go back and look at what Paul did, he created a whole separate interface here for the same exact information. So that's really telling. That's it's very similar to what Amazon has done with books. They've used the same information that Barnes & Noble has, but Amazon has created a better interface for it. So what we're seeing in Web 2.0 is that the interface, in some cases, if the rest of the information is public, if everybody can use Google Maps, for example, and everybody can use Craigslist, which they can because they're public information sources, that the interfaces we're building actually are where competition is taking place. So a focus on an interface is going to be much higher. Focus on interface innovation is going to be much higher than it has been in the past. Okay, so this is just quickly how Housing Maps works, or if you were to build something like Housing Maps. Google Maps API basically gives you rules as to how you create your own maps. So if I'm a JavaScript coder, which I am sometimes, I can just make some JavaScript calls and have maps on my website. It's very simple to use. If you go to, I think it's maps.google.com/API or something similar to that, then you can see all the code that you need to use. Very simple. This is it's so useful for almost every organization and company I can think of. Who wouldn't want their own map to show people how to get there, all this stuff? In fact, I was using a similar feature to get here this morning. So Craigslist, the real estate listings are available in RSS, so people can subscribe to them. Well, Paul Rademacher could subscribe to Craigslist to get all those housing feeds. So then he pulls all those down, and he pulls the maps down, and then he creates this one interface using both. So RSS, in that light, can be seen as an API to your data. Okay, it's providing your data in textual form, and you're basically giving people permission to do whatever they want with it. And if they just want to read it and say, oh, that book's new, okay, that's cool, I'll go check it out. Or if they want to build something like housing maps, they can do that too. So it's really a hacking enabler. RSS is a hacking enabler, that if you provide your content in RSS, you're saying to the world, here it is, take it and do what you will. So hacker innovation, just to quickly recap, Housing Maps was created by Paul Rademacher. He was he worked at DreamWorks. Now he works at Google. They wouldn't want to let him go. And he may have unwittingly hastened the destruction of the entire real estate industry with only 30 or 40 hours of work. So new enabling technologies. These technologies are really changing the way that everything is done. I went over RSS and APIs. REST is kind of an approach about kind of how to build your APIs. And permalinks, of course. Permalinks are the fine-grained URLs to, say, a blog post or any small piece of content that you put out. And those really allow for finer-grained attention. So people can link to any little bit of your site. And, in fact, most do. Okay, so lessons learned from the dot-bomb survivors. New enabling technologies. These are two big parts of Web 2.0. The one I want to talk about now is social software best practices. And I've mentioned blogs. Of course, blogs are the social software of now. And excuse me. So social software best practices. First, I want to talk about tagging and aggregate behavior. Tagging is a very, very simple mechanism that a lot of sites are taking advantage of. In fact, Amazon just added tagging this past week. What tagging is providing a mechanism for people to simply attach a word to something, okay? And to give you an example, tagging on Amazon now is you go to a book page or a book product page, and you can tag it with anything that you want. Okay, so say I'm looking at this Tim O'Reilly in a Nutshell book, and I tag it O'Reilly. And then I go to another book by O'Reilly, and I tag that one O'Reilly. And then I go to some other book and tag that O'Reilly. Well, Amazon has created a page for all your O'Reilly tags, or all the pages that you've tagged O'Reilly. So now you can go to Amazon and say, you know what, I remember seeing an O'Reilly book. I don't remember the title of it. So then you go to your tag page, and you say, oh, there it is, because all those tags are saved. Tagging is a really interesting phenomenon that we're only beginning to understand. Tagging seems to work best when it's done on a personal or selfish level. And what I mean by that is, if I'm tagging something like a book on Amazon or a bookmark on Delicious, I tag it for my own use. So I might tag it with the author's last name, with one of the topics in it, with simply a tag like to read. So that the next time I go into those applications, I can say, oh, these are all the things that I want to read, or that I marked to read. So now I can look those things up. The very interesting thing about tagging is that when we take one person's personal, it's been called a tag space, but set collection of tags, and we compare it to someone else's, we learn a lot. If you do like trend analysis, if you aggregate these things together, you can find out for one thing, what people are talking about, what people think is worth saving, what people think is worth marking to come back to. So now, let's say Amazon has tagging on their website for 6 months. After 6 months, they know what words people associate with all their books. So they know what words are going through people's heads as they're shopping for those books. They could, if they wanted to, rewrite their whole information architecture to model those exact words. That's one thing you can do with tags. Other things you can do with tags is, and by the way, when you aggregate tags in this way, it's often called a folksonomy. a term coined by Thomas Vanderwall. And what you see in these folksonomies as you look at these trends is really how people associate with the digital content that they're interacting with. Let me give you an example. Here is my Delicious page, okay? Delicious is a, I believe they describe themselves as a social bookmarking site. And what that means is instead of keeping all my bookmarks, say, in Firefox or IE, I instead keep them on Delicious, and I can access them from any browser, anywhere, at any time. So instead of having my bookmarks on this machine and then going to, say, an MIT campus machine where I won't have them, now, if I simply log into my Delicious account, I'll always have them everywhere. So that's the main use of Delicious. And here's my Delicious page. If you look, so Bocardo is like my name in cyberspace. So that's what that means. So here are my latest bookmarks. And you can see I have 640 of them. The last thing that I bookmarked is an article called Principles Behind Agile Manifesto. And the thing that I bookmarked before that is The Long Tail of a Black Hat. So those are just names of web pages that I bookmarked. What you'll see under them is these little words. It says 2 Agile, Web 2.0, 2 Search Engine Spammers, Long Tail, Web 2.0. Those are the tags that I assigned to those bookmarks when I made them. This is how it works. Okay, this is the Agile Manifesto page that I found somehow. I have no idea how I found it. And I said, oh, you know, that's something that I want to remember, or I want to read it later, or I want to remember it for some reason. So then I go up to the top of my browser. I happen to use Safari on a Mac. And I have this, what's called a bookmarklet. And I won't get into that. But anyway, I click this, and up comes this screen, okay? So it basically, that little bookmarklet calls Delicious and says, okay, Josh wants to bookmark this page. So then this page is sent to me. And then down here, I add certain tags that I want to remember. And I can also put in notes here. So the tags that I added here, and I was just kind of screwing around for the screenshot, so they're not the exact same tags, because I did this after the fact. I'm sorry, did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay, I'll repeat it.
Okay. So do you use this now in place of, you know, favorites
from on your web browser? And can you just tell us to people that don't know maybe how long these tags stay out there? Beatrice asked if I use this instead of favorites on my browser, and the answer is absolutely yes. And to answer the second part of the question, which is a question a lot of people have, is this account safe? Are my bookmarks going to be there for a long time? I can't answer that for sure, but I do know that the the folks at Delicious are growing. They've gotten venture capital, and they're going to continue growing and making a real business out of this. So their goal is to have these bookmarks around for a long time. And as of right now, I've been very happy with the service, and so I trust them to keep my bookmarks safe.
And are your bookmarks private?
The bookmarks are public. There are new features that people have been clamoring for, and there will probably be more features to come that kind of set some bookmarks apart. So like if I didn't want you guys to see that bookmark on my main Bocardo page, then I might be able to hide it in some way. But as of right now, almost everything's public on the website. So you can go to my page and see what I'm bookmarking. In fact, that's a really interesting way to know what people are talking about. If you know, like for example, I could go to someone famous. I don't know if Seth Godin has a tagging page, but if he did, I could go there and see what he's tagging or see what he's saving, which is really cool. I mean, who wouldn't want to know what you know, what one of the leading marketers in the world is paying attention to. So you guys could go see what I'm paying attention to, and I could go see what you're paying attention to. So after I write in my tags, I click save. And so then you see that it's added back, it's added to the top page of my Delicious account. This is actually not the top page of my Delicious account. This is the page for my Web 2.0 tagged items. So you'll see at the top that this is Bocardo/Web 2.0. So this is all the things that I've tagged Web 2.0. So this is where the service becomes very powerful. So over the months, I tag things Web 2.0. I tag things Web 2.0. I tag this Web 2.0. I tag that Web 2.0. I tag everything Web 2.0 that even has anything to do with Web 2.0. Then last night, when when I'm writing an article about Web 2.0, I go to Delicious and I say, remind me of all the things that I've tagged Web 2.0. So I go to this page, and now I see my whole history back months and months and months, and all those pages that were valuable to me at one time that I completely forgot about, they're all here.
But isn't it true that some of those pages might disappear in that time?
Yes, if they're taken off the server, absolutely. And it, of course, wouldn't be taken out of my account because I'm just holding like a bookmark to it. Okay. So this is my Web 2.0 page. And if you see up here on the top, it says view recommendations. Okay, this is where tagging becomes very powerful. If I go, this is, you can see on the URL, this is the Web 2.0 recommended items. So these are other people who use the Web 2.0 tag, who tag things a lot like I tag them. And this is really the power of the Folksonomy, that now I can go discover new information from other people that I never would have known about otherwise, simply because we're tagging things similarly. Down here, you have recommended items for your Web 2.0 tag. So these are items that a lot of people have tagged Web 2.0, specific items. So up here we have users, other Delicious users who are tagging things similar to me. Down here we have items that were tagged with the same tags. So now you can see the power of Delicious as a research tool above and beyond what you do for your personal use. Yes, we had a question up back. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Say instead of typing in Web 2.0 for your tag, you typed in Web 2.0 GSA for some random reason.
Okay.
And that's your tag for Web 2.0 in your head.
Right.
Will it bring up all these other Web 2.0? Because it's like, oh, you're tagging all these things. These are the same types of things. Does it have that kind of capability?
Well, it's basically just pattern matching with the tags. So if I tag it GSD, it's going to give me recommendations for things other people have tagged GSD. And the amazing thing is, and this is one of the big criticisms of services like Delicious, is that you tag it NYC, I tag it New York, and someone else tags it the Big Apple, and another person tags it New York City. So there's all this overlap. But what it's actually doing, okay, and this is something I feel very strongly about, is it's showing the nuances that we have in language. And so if something is Web 2.0 to me, that actually means something different to me than if I typed GSD. And so if I tag something the Big Apple, to me that's actually different than if I tagged it NYC. And so if the Big Apple has different connotations, as does NYC. NYC is an abbreviation. The Big Apple is a nickname. You know, there are subtle differences. A lot of times, information architects especially worry about having like this set in stone answer So why? So if we're going to allow all this ambiguity in tagging, then we're going to miss a lot. Because if you want to look up New York City as a subject, you might miss something that's tagged NYC. My response to that is that it's exact tagging it models the way people talk. And so if I'm talking to you, I'm completely messy in what I say. And I might say, you know, if I say something to you, I went to New York City the other day, you're not going to say, you know what, that's the same as NYC or New York or the Big Apple, you know, because there's an understanding there. And so all the ambiguities that are in language also exist on Delicious. And I think that's actually part of the beauty of the system, that we're modeling the way that we actually think about content rather than assuming that there's some inherent structure in the content and trying to tease that out instead. Okay, moving on. So here's a tag. Here's the tag Web 2.0 from everybody in the Delicious system. So these are the things that everybody in the system has tagged Web 2.0. Okay, so mine actually doesn't show up here because these are like, you know, the last 10 things tagged Web 2.0, and Web 2.0 is a popular tag now, so there's like 10 a minute or something. So this page is always changing. So if you want to do research on any topic, go to Delicious, go to the tag page for that topic, and you'll see what everyone else is tagging that topic, and you can see really interesting things. I often go to this page when I want to like see what's going on around the topic of Web 2.0, and it helps me, you know, come up with ideas for talks and research and things like that. So again, this is hacker innovation. Joshua Schachter created Delicious in his spare time. He quit his job after an initial round of funding. They were having big scalability problems, but I think as I mentioned, that's a huge problem because, you know, all of a sudden you just have a lot of people interested in your service. You can't take your site down, or you can only take it down for an hour or two, else people get angry. So how do you scale a system while it's live? You know, that's just a crazy question that I'm glad I don't have to deal with right now. So anyway, he may have found, and unwittingly found, or perhaps wittingly, I know it wasn't very planned, a great way to organize huge amounts of information by making some traditional information architecture techniques pale in comparison. So if you look at like a taxonomy that is defined ahead of time, it's got a completely different set of data than something like a folksonomy, which is created from the actual use of participants. So social software best practices. Folksonomies, which I went through, harness personal and social behavior. And they provide an amazingly rich insight into how people relate to their digital items on the web. Blogs, you know, so many people talk about blogs, but what I think one of the most important things is that they harness individual voices and conversations with those readers. So we're just modeling conversations here. It can be as simple or as complex as that. Wikis promote collaboration. We actually use a wiki at work quite a bit, and we're certainly seeing limitations with it, but we're also seeing that if we put stuff up on the wiki, that it's kind of archived and it's this kind of social collaborative space, and we're pleased with it. We're actually using it, so you know your results may vary, but anyway, the best practices in general are providing tools to discover, recommend, share, and promote word of mouth. We're simply doing what we did offline, and we're doing it online. So now I want to kind of come out with what I think is the biggest takeaway from this whole change that we're going through. Call it what you want. I'm going to call it Web 2.0. I guess my question would be, what do all these things have in common? What have we learned from the dot-bomb survivors? What are we seeing with these new enabling technologies? And what have we gleaned in terms of software social best practices that help us bring or inform our own design, in which we have our own problems and our own issues and our own politics? What can we take away from there Well, I think there's a great example of this. This is the Flickr page for my boss, Jared. Flickr is a site that's about uploading your personal photos and sharing them. They've actually only been out like a year and a half, but after about a year, they were sold to Yahoo for like $30 million because they had so many people using it. The Flickr users are so passionate. The user base was growing so well. They were making a lot of money because they had a paid level that people were loving. You can like upload as many pictures as you want. Just a great interface, great service. But on this page, you see, so I can surf to Jared's page. This is my boss, Jared's pool. And he's male and 44. So he has a bunch of these contacts down below. And so these are the people that he's been paying attention to. So he wants to basically see their photo streams. But then you have this next page that if you want to add them as a contact. So if I want Jared's pictures to show up on my pages as kind of it's very much like the Delicious, you know, see what other people are doing, but it's see what other people are taking photos of is basically but they've explicitly called out what I think is the biggest takeaway from Web 2.0. Would you also like to mark this person as a friend, as a family, or as a contact? Okay, they're being very explicit here. How do you relate to this person in your offline life? What is that relationship to you? So then you click one, you say okay. So you're making an explicit relationship online that you have offline. So now, these are the photos from my contacts. So I see photos from this guy, Bill HD, and I see photos from Jared. So this is my online representation of my offline life. So Web 2.0 made explicit. What do these things have in common? What does the lessons learned from the dot-bomb survivors, the most valuable uses of new enabling technologies, and the best practices in social software teach us? Well, I think it teaches us that design works best when it models user behavior. So in general, from a high-level standpoint, Google models how we value content by looking at what we link to. Amazon models how we value books by looking at what we buy, what we wish for, how we review them. Flickr models how we share photos by allowing us to mark people as friends, family, by seeing who we send our pictures to. Delicious models how we save things and how we might use them for research. Housing Maps models how we find real estate. Okay, so I think the final piece is that designed by modeling human user behavior is really the key change that we're seeing, that we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years, that the web is teaching us. Okay, instead of coming up with a site like boo.com, where it's kind of if you build it, they will come mentality. We've seen sites like Amazon say, if we can model how your offline life works, then you'll keep coming back for more and more. So now I've re-quoted this. The accretion of tiny hacks can numb us to the arrival of the stupendous. Yes, exactly. Great. I love it. I remixed it. And that's my talk today. Thank you.